Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, early voting is underway with large and, in some cases, record-setting turnout here and nationwide. How does it compare to 2020, and what might it mean to the outcome? Donald Trump returns to the state to campaign, continuing to lie about the federal response to Hurricane Helene. Mark Robinson amends the amount of damages he's seeking in his defamation lawsuit against CNN, changing it from $50 million to $25,000, but that does not tell the full story, and we will fill you in. And although the Panthers are struggling, Charlotte FC goes to the playoffs for the second time in 2 years. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Nick Oxner is WBTV's chief investigative reporter, and Alexandria Sands is a reporter with Axios Charlotte. Good morning to you all. Welcome back.
Morning.
Good morning. So as we enter the waning days of this presidential campaign, candidates and surrogates are stumping the key battleground states, and that explains the appearance of President Barack Obama today and Donald Trump earlier this week in North Carolina. On Monday, Trump visited Swannanoa, where he praised local recovery efforts but criticized the federal government's response to Hurricane Helene.
The power of nature. Nothing you can do about it, but you got to get a little bit better crew in to do a better job than has been done by the White House. It's been not good.
The claims of inadequate or partisan or non-existent support from the state and from FEMA and from the White House have all been resoundingly debunked. Why does he continue to lie about these efforts?
This has become a talking point for him in North Carolina. When he comes here, he brings up the hurricane and FEMA and the idea that people are, that FEMA is spending money on people that are crossing the border illegally. He repeated this, I think the Observer had this three times when he was in Asheville, and then again in Greenville in his rally, and then again in Concord. So it's becoming one of those things that we all know that Donald Trump has his talking points he repeats over and over, and that's his North Carolina one.
North Carolina Republican Chuck Edwards issued a press release, I think just last week, debunking what he called these Helene response myths, his words, being spread by Donald Trump, his fellow Republican, and others in that party. He stood, however, behind Trump at this rally on Monday as Donald Trump said these words. Did he take issue with anything that was said at the event, Nick?
No, of course not. He didn't. He sat there and actually he didn't go as far as I don't think Trump did. But, you know, he sat there and again, basically said, look how great Donald Trump is. I'm paraphrasing. Look how great Donald Trump is. And look how bad the federal response has been, which as he was saying, and I was there as he was saying, and I was thinking to myself, this literally contradicts the thing you said a week ago.
The people in that area, in Swannanoa, elsewhere in western North Carolina, they know what has been happening there. They can see it. They have experienced it. Local officials in those areas have praised consistently, without question, praised the response from FEMA and the White House. Substantial work has been done in these areas on repairing roads and restoring water and electric power and cell systems. Are these untruths that Trump is saying about the response for an audience outside that area? Or does he really believe that victims won't believe what they lived through? They will instead believe him.
I think it's a bit of both. And I think that this continues to just go, and it's partisan, right? Because what he said was your governor, a Democrat, Roy Cooper, mm-hmm. in North Carolina, is not doing a great job, but not as good of a job as the governors in Georgia and South Carolina, Republicans. And so it's pure politics for the sake of having a talking point. Why is FEMA doing a bad job? Because a Democrat is president of the United States and oversees FEMA.
Mary?
Yes, and I also want to say that
Response to disasters used to be nonpartisan, but increasingly they've become partisan. Not just now, but when Obama was president with Hurricane Sandy, you saw a partisan divide. You saw, Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey get slammed because he actually hugged the president of the United States. And there's a danger to this because there are some people in those areas who are staunch Republicans who listen only to Donald Trump. And there have been cases of people not reaching out to FEMA because they believe some of these lies about if you ask FEMA for help, they're going to take your property. And you do see these Republicans like Tim Moore, Speaker of the House, like Senator Ted Budd, standing behind Trump. And even folks that weren't there, someone like a Senator Tom Tillis that people used to think it was rather moderate, he is increasingly tweeting support for Trump and actually doubling down on some of these things Trump is saying. So while we can say it's partisan politics, yes, they're playing these games. These games are with people's lives. And so that's why there's a real world damage. As parts of the highways out there are opening up and the people out there are trying to get people to come so they won't, so they'll have a pretty good holiday season. And this is at the same time, and they're worried that people might not come.
Yeah, I know that Nick wants to jump in here, but Steve, I want to know, as a political reporter, is there a price to be paid for these consistent and constant lies about things that we can see and experience with our own eyes, or have we entered a new period in politics where it doesn't matter anymore?
I'd say we're in the new period where it really doesn't matter anymore. I think if you total kind of everything that's been said in the past 6 months, and then this piece about FEMA and the hurricane. I'm not saying it's insignificant. I'm not trying to say that, but I'm just saying in the grand total of things, it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And I think for former President Trump, I mean, there are people in Western North Carolina, when you lose everything, that, they're very frustrated. They're devastated.
Sure.
And he's saying, true or untrue, he's saying like, well, I'm going to be your guy. And so I do think there is some local strategy involved. I think he is kind of like saying, I'm going to be your voice. I'm not saying the voice is correct, but that's, I think, what he's counting on. And of course, that's a big deal out there because there's a lot of Republican voters that were impacted by the storm, and he needs them to show up and vote.
Nick?
Well, we should also, I just wanted to jump in because Mary said the name Tim Moore, the Speaker of the State House, who unleashed his own untruth at that press conference Monday, saying that he'd gotten calls from Trump but hadn't gotten calls from the White House. And a spokesperson later confirmed the White House had sent multiple emails and had called his office. So that's the thing here. It's important to say that Trump typically has an effect on local Republican or state level Republican officials who suddenly launch their own things that are just not true.
Well, if they lie about things that are absolutely provably false, we see it, we've experienced it, we know it to be false. How can we trust anything they say about anything?
Well, that's a hard question you threw at me, Mike. And that is, I'm going to say that is going to be up to the individual voter. And, I think the media has certainly tried to do its job over the last 4 years or 9 years in trying to debunk a lot of what's said. But yes, I don't know. That's hard to say.
Mary?
I also really wanted to quickly say when he said the media, well, that's another problem. People are getting their news in silos. So if you turn on certain networks, say Fox News, you will hear some of these untruths amplified, which is interesting since they paid almost $1 billion in damages for lies they told in broadcast in the last election, but it doesn't seem to have made a difference.
With more possible fines to come, because the other company that's involved in voting machines that are also alleging Fox News lied about them, that suit has yet to come to court. You had the opportunity, Nick, because you were at that rally in Swannanoa, you had an opportunity to ask Donald Trump a question about the impact of his lies on the work that FEMA is doing. I want to play your question and his response and then get your thoughts.
President Trump, A armed gunman was arrested, charged with making threats against FEMA workers two Saturdays ago. FEMA had a safety stand down because of continued credible threats. Is it helping the recovery effort in North Carolina to keep making these claims that FEMA's not doing their job?
Well, I think you have to let people know how they're doing. If they were doing a great job, I think we should say that too, because I think they should be rewarded. But if they're not doing, does that mean that if they're doing a poor job, we're supposed to not say it? These people are entitled to say it.
These people are entitled to say it. Only he is saying it. So what did you take from that exchange?
Yeah, look, I don't think anyone was surprised that this was his answer, but I think it's the first time we've heard him answer that question, so I thought it was important to ask it.
But he didn't answer the question. Hold it, Nick. He didn't answer the question. Kamala Harris has been reasonably criticized for often skirting answers to direct questions. You asked him a direct question in that clip, and he prevaricated. Did he say something later that was outside of that clip that gave you an answer?
I'm going to take your ellipses for a second, because I think it's important to say, since we're going to make a direct comparison between Trump and Harris on answering media questions, is I've now this campaign cycle gotten to ask J.D. Vance a question and Donald Trump a question. There have been exactly zero opportunities that I've gotten to ask Kamala Harris or Tim Walz a question, despite covering many of their events. So, Mike, anytime someone gives any public official, whether it's Roy Cooper, Donald Trump, Tim Moore, Vi Lyles, responds to a question. How about, I won't use the word answer, I'll say respond. And I think that response was telling. One, in its non-answer. Two, that he continued to just make a baseless claim. He didn't say they're doing a bad job because X, Y, and Z. He just said they're doing a bad job. And then he didn't say, I'm saying they're doing a bad job. He said, as you just honed in at the start of the question, these people are saying it. He's the people. And he's making this straw man argument, right? That, oh, and so at the most, what you might have heard from folks in North Carolina involved in the recovery is that there was, I think it's been worked out now, but in the week or so after the storm hit, there was a backlog.
It's the local news roundup. Lots of things to talk about as we go through the hour this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Go ahead, Nick, I'm sorry.
There was a backlog of you know, a kink getting the stuff from, you know, the federal government sent it, and then you have to get it distributed. And we know part of the reason people probably aren't seeing FEMA at their house is because this federal aid is being distributed by dropping it off at fire departments, churches, volunteer centers, and then letting those organizations distribute it. So when people say, I haven't seen FEMA in my house, that's by design.
Mary Trump did say that he would be in favor of Congress returning early to provide additional relief funding for this hurricane. House Speaker Mike Johnson has already said that will not happen. And of course, the election is next week and members of Congress are out running for office. They're not going to come back to do this right now. But given Trump's influence on Congress that we have seen demonstrated, particularly when it comes to the immigration bill, had he really wanted them to come back, wouldn't Mike Johnson have done his bidding?
I think so. Just because we saw when he didn't want them to act on the immigration compromise bipartisan bill, they did not. It is the party of Trump. And usually when Mike Johnson now is on the air, he's defending and explaining things about Trump. So I think right now they would like it to stay as it is so he can continue to say the people in Western North Carolina with its Democratic governor, they are suffering and it's the fault of the Democrats. So I can't predict, though. I can't look into his mind or Mike Johnson's mind. I'm just saying, by observation, it would be a fair judgment to think that.
Another thing he was saying a lot was that if he won the election, that he was going to completely rebuild and it was going to be greater than ever before. They would have a new crew to help out. So there were some campaign promises made while he was there.
And Project 2025, if you look at that, they want to actually shrink FEMA and turn it over to the state. So
shut down the National Weather Service. We would not have known about hurricanes. They're one of the major components in the worldwide forecasting of weather. There's a European version, there's us, and there's one other one in the world, and we are one of the big players. You turn that off, You're operating in the dark. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk about more things with regard to Donald Trump and Obama's visit to Charlotte today and more on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is with us from WFAE News. He's our political reporter. Nick Oxner's the chief investigative reporter for WBTV. Alexandria Sands, a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Mary C. Curtis, the columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Steve, Donald Trump was also here in Concord for a rally on Monday night. It was his third event of the day. And in your reporting on this, you say he sounded subdued, even low energy, but he had enough energy to accuse Vice President Harris of being hostile to Christianity. Why? In what way?
Well, there were a litany of reasons that he listed. I remember one, of course, was that he brought up transgender rights again and healthcare and transgender women and women's sports. That was a big one. But yeah, it was his third event of the day. He was in Western North Carolina and then I think went to Greenville. So he only spoke for 50 minutes, which in Trump world is like, that's just nothing. You know, usually he goes for 90 minutes. The theme of the rally was faith leaders. And that was it.
And while he was here, he claimed that he had been working toward ending religious persecution worldwide, adding, quote, "Nobody has done what I've done in terms of religion, in terms of Christianity," end quote. Did he elaborate on that? I mean, what has he done worldwide?
You know, I think his big thing he points to is the three justices he appointed to the court, and in his view, them upholding religious values, and you know, in his world, that is his main pivot point, and really the biggest source of support, or the biggest for a lot of Christian conservatives, the most important thing he's done.
White Christian conservatives. And I really want to get in here, Mike, because I did a conference call with the Reverend William Barber and his organization, and where he highlighted, and they spoke, three people of low income and talked about their struggles and how their attempts to raise the minimum wage, which hasn't been raised for years, and it's been blocked in Congress mainly by Republicans. And I realized that one thing I don't hear at these white evangelical Christian rallies for Trump is they talk about power, but they don't talk about poverty, which I think is really in that Bible that Trump is selling, that, you know, they don't talk about the poor. They talk about ascending to power and making this country a Christian country, where, of course, we are not. We're a secular country. And he is saying that because he was spared from assassination, that was a signal from God. And people were saying Jesus. It really seemed rather blasphemous because, of course, this is a country where people of any faith or no faith, we are all equal and we have equal rights. And now he seems to be turning into these religious rallies, and it really seems un-American.
Well, he was joined in Concord when he was here last Monday by Franklin Graham and by Ben Carson and his son Eric, who had this to say about his father.
He was put here for this mission to save this country. We need God in our life. We need God in society. We need children to respect God. We need God in our schools.
Trump, now a messianic figure, I suppose, Steve. The idea that Trump has somehow been anointed by God is something that has been frequently floated by the far right in the Christian community. Some see him as a kind of savior to the nation, despite his too numerous to count peccadilloes. And you report that prior to his visit, Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles and others pointed out his misuse of faith-based organizations selling things like the Trump-branded Bibles. Does any of this talk matter? Isn't this all now completely baked in on both sides?
I would say yes. I think the cake is pretty well baked. I mean, one of the big themes that Eric Trump talked about was after Pennsylvania, the assassination attempt, that his life was saved. That was divine intervention. I think that the assassination attempts have kind of further solidified his supporters' view that that happened for a reason, and that he is here only by, and this is what Eric Trump said, only by the grace of God.
He also promised while he was in Concord to create a new federal task force on finding anti-Christian bias. This is one of his many efforts to root out evil in the government and in the country, I suppose. That's using his words or paraphrasing his words. He said that effort would begin immediately. Is there any evidence anywhere that we can find of anti-Christian bias, or is this just another page from the white Christian nationalist playbook?
I think that no. In fact, you see the opposite happening in some states, Oklahoma and Tennessee, some other states where they are mandating that there will be Bibles in classrooms and Ten Commandments on the walls, which it's actually, it looks like it is promoting Christianity. So it seems like just the opposite. But you can understand why he's saying this, because this is his most fervent base, his most loyal voters. And right now he's running a base campaign to try to, you know, get those voters to go to the polls and overwhelm everyone else. While he does things like demonize immigrants and focus his attacks on the Vice President Harris, in very personal and insulting terms. So you'll see at these Christian rallies with Trump, these t-shirts and pamphlets that talk about Vice President Kamala Harris in the most base and insulting terms. And you wonder how they actually, it seems quite hypocritical, but there you go.
And he closed his remarks in Concord on Monday by urging Christians to go out and vote. But he quickly pivoted to secular topics, including this old war horse.
We will quickly become energy independent again. You know, we were energy independent just 4 years ago. And we will frack, frack, frack.
Under the Biden administration, the United States has pumped more oil than any other nation in the history of the planet. But the world's energy supply, including the price of gasoline, is globally intertwined. And both Trump and Biden, despite record-setting oil production, have imported oil. We also exported oil. So is this just a red herring, a canard?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, but people see the facts they've shown in different polls and studies. How if President Trump says we're doing poorly in this area, even though gas prices may be dropping, inflation may be dropping, all of these things, his supporters will see that as the truth. And you know, on the other side, I would say it's the same. So right now, because once upon a time, the Vice President Harris said she would ban fracking. Now she has since come off of that, and her actions as vice president, they haven't banned fracking anywhere, but he's using that to say that she is not for production of energy in the United States.
So the Eminem quoting Barack Obama is scheduled to hold a rally for the Harris Waltz campaign here in Charlotte today. What do we know about it? When and where? Alex.
We know it's tonight at the convention center. They're going to be sending in the big guns, Obama. Harris has already been here, and I think that the Democratic Party is going to hope that this drives some voters, because they really need Mecklenburg County to show up if they are going to have a chance of electing Harris in this state. And we know Obama was the last president to win North Carolina. He has a fan base here, so I'm sure Governor Cooper would say over a few times that 2008 feeling people get excited about.
Yes, solidly blue Mecklenburg County has traditionally low voter turnout, and they say that if there was high voter turnout, it might make the state blue in the presidential race, which is very tight. Recent polls show Donald Trump leading the vice president by half a percentage point in North Carolina, while Harris leads Trump by just under 1%, according to Real Clear Politics. It really does depend on which poll you're looking at and when that poll was taken and who those voters were that they talked to. But it is Pennsylvania that seems to be getting all the attention, as that state evidently will determine the outcome. Are we no longer all that important in this race?
Oh, we're real important, because even though Pennsylvania has 19 electoral votes, we have 16. So Trump feels the Republicans that it's a must win for them. And the Democrats would love to have it, because it would really show her strength. And then it would be insurance if she falters in any of those blue wall states or in Pennsylvania. So that's why you see the, and Obama is a big gun. I was looking at, listening to his rally in Georgia, and he is an incredibly gifted politician who can really make a point and connect to people. So I think everybody, people I saw in the gym and whatever, are signed up to go. So, and he's going to have some special guests. Bruce Springsteen showed up in Georgia, so you don't know.
Yeah.
But J.D. Vance will be here. He'll be in Monroe at the same time doing a town hall. So he'll be Obama's competition.
And will that be on television, the town hall?
I'm not sure, but he'll be the same night, same tonight.
All right. Nick?
Yeah, so it is not hyperbole or exaggeration to say that North Carolina and Pennsylvania are the top two important states in this presidential election. Like Mary touched on, this is a must win for Donald Trump. But the problem is no one's winning it, right? I mean, the polls are statistically tied and have been statistically tied for 2 months. The High Point University poll this week had of registered voters, not likely voters, but a very high sample size, 1,100 people. Had Harris up 1, a Marist poll out, I think yesterday, had Trump up 2. Both of those are within the margin of error, and all the polls have been within the margin. That's why you see Trump camped out here for 2 days in a row. That's why you see Trump and Vance in North Carolina, each of them at least 1 day a week for the last 8 weeks. That's why you see Obama coming today in the Harris campaign. And so it very much is anyone's game here. And in similar respects, Harris really needs to win Pennsylvania. I still don't think it's as critical to her map as North Carolina is to Trump's, but Harris really needs to win Pennsylvania. And again, it's a toss-up, and she's not, doesn't have it locked down like she would like.
And nationally, Mike, I was going to say, Mike, you talked about the Obama visit coming to Charlotte. I think it's important because you mentioned earlier Mecklenburg County needing high turnout. Right now, through early voting, it's below the state average again. That's a problem for Democrats. African-American turnout is also, at this point, not where it needs to be for the Democratic Party for Kamala Harris to win. It's African-Americans are about 17.5% of the people who've cast votes so far. That number needs to be about 20 or 21 for... So, unless Harris gets overwhelming support from unaffiliated, that number needs to be higher.
What is wrong with Mecklenburg County and their traditionally low voter turnout? Is it, since we are fundamentally a blue county, is it that Democrats are just laissez-faire, they're just lazy, or is it something else? What's going on here? Why don't we vote?
A $1 million question, and it's a multi-million dollar question in terms of the amount of money that is being spent here by the state, by the county, and by the Kamala Harris campaign to try and boost turnout. It's been a huge thing, a huge issue for several elections, but top of mind for the last 2 years to try and ramp it up.
Well, and just think of the number of transient folks we have in and out of this county, and that there aren't many people from here who live here now. Compare that to a rural area where it's mostly folks who are from there, or even the Triangle, which, you know, also has a lot of transplants, but certainly has a lot of people who are actually from there as well still. And it's just significantly less buy-in, I think, in our community. And we see this up and down from the city council to the governor's office.
Anecdotally, I voted early on the very first day of voting at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and had to wait for 30 minutes to get in. And usually on early voting, no matter which day I choose to go, I walk right in, do my thing, and get right back out. I thought that was a good sign, but maybe not good enough. Nationally, according to the University of Florida's Election Lab, which tracks early votes, nearly 29 million votes have been cast by yesterday afternoon. In Georgia, more than 2.1 million people, maybe higher this morning, had cast votes. Both North and South Carolina had set new records for first day voting. I think over 125,000 people in South Carolina voted on the first day, while more than 350,000 people in North Carolina had turned out. Do we know where those numbers stand today?
Yeah, I can't speak to South Carolina, but in North Carolina, the biggest, the headline of early voting has been that Republicans have really come out. They have made a big effort over the last 4 years to get Republicans to vote early because, of course, traditionally they prefer Election Day. Donald Trump has demonized early voting. He still does at times, and then he will kind of get back on script and talk about how it is important to vote early. I think yesterday, in terms of raw vote total, Republicans took the lead, not just in terms of a percent, but in terms of the actual number. I think that was the first time that's ever happened in the history of North Carolina early voting. I just looked at the numbers again this morning. They've widened that lead. Now about 17,000 more Republicans have voted than Democrats. So just kind of looking at it nationally and looking at Democratic groups and people talk about it, I think nationally in a lot of states, Democrats feel good about where they are in early voting. But North Carolina is one where people are now acknowledging that the early data does not look so as favorable as it does in other places.
It's the Charlotte Talks local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Nick?
Yeah, you look no further than the fact that Donald Trump was asked at least three times at his press conference in Swannanoa on Monday whether or not he had any reason to doubt the results in North Carolina because of the hurricane and the disruption it had caused. It went first by Fox News and then a couple different ways by a correspondent from NBC News. He did not take that bait. He said, no, things are going great, and I can't believe the great turnout. And so that is a sign that Republicans feel good about their performance in early voting in North Carolina, that even Trump was beating back opportunities to call election fraud, which you know he would have taken had he not felt good about how the early vote was going.
Mary. But he's assuming that all the Republican votes are for him, which we don't know. You don't know if the Republican early vote is cannibalizing the Election Day vote. You wonder where all the independents are going, and the unaffiliated, rather. And then also, where are the Nikki Haley voters who voted for her in the primary going? Maybe a lot went home to the Republican Party and Trump. Nikki Haley herself has endorsed Trump. But at the same time, are there folks who were never Trumpers who now are going to either sit home or are voting early and voting, but voting for the Democrat? Because you have a lot of Republicans who are campaigning with and endorsing Kamala Harris. So is it predictive? I guess we'll know soon.
And among Democrats, there are concerns about turning out black voters. I think, Steve, you quoted Democratic political consultant Thomas Mills in one of your stories as saying that Democrats can't continue to hemorrhage votes among the black community and hope to stay competitive. What has the black voter turnout been so far? Do we know?
Yeah, it's like I said earlier, it's about black vote. I'll go back. Black voters are about just under 20% of registered voters in North Carolina. Right now, if you look at the pool of people who have voted, it's about 17.5% African-American. That number, for Democrats to win, it needs to be 20, 21, 22. That's what happened in the Obama era, and that's what needs to happen again in 2024.
I have 20 seconds, Mary.
Yes, if Kamala Harris loses, it won't be because black folks didn't turn out. It will be because Donald Trump got a huge majority of white voters. So Democrats have been depending upon black voters to save them.
Maybe they shouldn't make that depend. They shouldn't depend on it. Yeah. We have to stop. We'll come right back with more in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison's with us. Our WFAE political reporter, Mary C. Curtis, is a columnist for Roll Call and host of their Equal Time podcast. Nick Oxner's the chief investigative reporter for WBTV, and Alexandria Stans is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Before we move on to other topics, Mecklenburg County's traditionally low voter turnout is a concern among Democrats. The amount of black voter turnout is another concern among Democrats. Jocelyn Nolley is chair of the Black Political Caucus of Charlotte-Mecklenburg.
I am nervous. This is a very close race. It's very important. So we are doing anything that sticks to get the black vote out.
What are they doing, Mary?
I did a panel with someone from the Black Voter Turnout Black Voter Project, and they are going around to different areas to different areas, say off Bates Ford Road, having guests to talk about the importance of the vote. It's difficult, though, when you see your own life not changing in certain ways to say, I'm frustrated, voting might not be the top thing on my list. But they're trying to make the connection between policies. Your life will change. As I like to say, you might not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. So when you see things like Trump talking about complete immunity for police who are allowed to have a day of violence, no action on the minimum wage, all of these issues, you realize that, yeah, my life as a Black person in the United States, you know, if they eliminate DEI and civil rights legislation, like it says in Project 2025, yes, it will count. But, and you also have to make sure you help them get to the polls, know what the polls are, know where they can vote, know when they can vote, when they've got jobs and families to deal with. So, like I said, doing everything, but, you know, it's white folks who are saying, yeah, I want this guy.
Trump has been campaigning. He has been campaigning on how horrible America is and what a hellhole this is and how bad crime is, when in fact it is not bad. Crime is down pretty much everywhere in the country. And yet he has advocated, as you pointed out, for a day of really rough violence against the perpetrators of crime. And he has also advocated that shoplifters be shot on sight. Meanwhile, yellow signs have been erected at voting sites placed there by the North Carolina Election Integrity Team, saying that it is a federal offense to vote as a non-citizen. And if you do, you could be deported. This is all true. I mean, that's absolutely right. You can't vote if you're not a citizen, and you could be deported if you're caught. This group combs through public voting records to find people who are ineligible to vote. So who is the North Carolina Election Integrity Team? Who are these people?
Well, this is a group that is an offshoot of a group formed by Cleta Mitchell, who became, we'll call her infamous, in the 2020 effort to overturn the election. It's run by Jim Womack here in North Carolina, and who claims he is not a conspiracy theorist in coverage of his current efforts.
Cleta Mitchell was part of, the Trump administration or his efforts to stay in power following the last election. Jim Womack, you say, is with the North Carolina Election Integrity Team. Here he is.
North Carolina is woefully inadequate in its processing of non-citizens. They still haven't started removing non-citizens from the voter rolls, which leaves us no recourse other than to monitor the voter lists and to advise citizens through these signs.
Is that true? Didn't the state just remove close to 750,000 citizens from the rolls last month and found only nine non-citizens on the list?
Look, let's talk about some actual facts here. Is that the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of North Carolina overlooked repeated and rampant election fraud in Bladen County because he was on a witch hunt, a wild goose chase for non-citizens voting in North Carolina. Guess what? He, I think, got like up to seven misdemeanor charges of non-citizens voting, and we had rampant election fraud in Bladen County, as we all know how that turned out in the 9th District. But more importantly, the Republican Party, the North Carolina Republican Party and the RNC recently filed a lawsuit in federal or in state court that got removed to federal court, where they tried to remove 225,000 voters 3 to 4 weeks before Election Day, claiming that the state violated a federal law in not ensuring that they are proper residents here. And that got thrown out of federal court and the state claim got remanded back to state court. But every time this claim has been made, it has not been able to be verified.
These are just voter suppression efforts, basically. Trump has a ceiling of 48%. He won with it in 2016. He lost in 2020. And they're just trying to get fewer numbers of people to vote. And these signs, they're in Spanish. So they're hoping maybe somebody will be, well, civil rights groups are saying this is voter intimidation as well.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because WFAE's Julian Berger, one of our reporters on our diversity team, says that although these yellow signs are factually accurate, some believe that they're being put up to scare Latino voters from the polls, and that includes Hector Vaca of Action NC.
It's definitely a targeted effort toward the non-English-speaking community, toward the immigrant community, so it's very targeted.
Action NC says it fights for racial, gender, and economic justice. Vaca says he is encouraging people who see these signs to report them to election officials at their polling place. Why? Is there legality in question?
Yes, and we should, my colleague Ron Lee did this story for WBTV last night, and so none of the signs that the state board has ruled should be removed from polling places were seen in Mecklenburg County. Others of these signs that are just factual are still up around the county. You could argue that all of them are aimed at having a deterrence effect, but there's a fine line here and slicing through the gray area of what is, you know, permissible and what is not.
Meanwhile, some good news and some bad news from Karen Brinson Bell. She's the executive director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections when she was on this program earlier this week. The good news comes from hurricane-ravaged areas of the state and actions taken to allow people there to vote.
Five sites could not be effectively opened, and so Buncombe will have 10 of their 14 sites open. McDowell will have one of their two planned sites open. And then Avery County was actually able to add a site to be of more service to the voters there. So, you know, 76 out of 80 is pretty remarkable.
Something altogether different that is also pretty remarkable and downright un-American are the threats elections officials have been receiving across the country. In North Carolina, Bell says the state is working to make sure voting sites are safe and election workers are protected. And she had this suggestion for voters.
What I would encourage is people to put those phones down, go sign up to be a poll worker and see how the process actually works and be supportive and recognize that the people, if you're not willing to do that, say thank you to the people who are working because they are, you know, the same people in your grocery store. They might sit by you at church. They might be your former basketball coach or English teacher, and they deserve a thank you more than the hatred that's being spewed.
So, several weeks ago, CNN reported that Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, they alleged that Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson had made some extreme comments on a pornographic website. They stand by those claims. Robinson has denied any involvement in them. He also hired legal counsel and initially sued CNN for $50 million. Now that amount has been reduced to $25,000, but there is a reason for that. Nick, what is it?
Yeah, there's a statute that caps the damages for a defamation claim. And this is what happens when your lead attorney is not licensed in North Carolina. Doesn't know the statute.
Well, I was going to ask because the bottom line here, it seems to me that's a state law. You can't sue for more than $25,000. If you get more than that, that's up to the jury in the trial. Why would they file for that amount of money if that's the law? They didn't know the law is what you're saying.
Basically. Yes.
Okay. So we'll wait and see.
But we should point out, Mike, I don't think this is particularly newsworthy. It's become newsworthy all over the state. This is a minor wrinkle. And I will be shocked if anything in this case actually moves forward before Election Day.
So one of the most highly anticipated election results on election night, Steve, will be in the race between Republican State House member Tricia Cotham and her Democratic challenger, Nicole Sidman. Cotham won last time as a Democrat, only to switch parties within minutes, it seemed, and give the GOP their supermajority in the legislature, allowing them to override Governor Cooper's vetoes. Democrats wanted revenge, but now Cotham's campaign is running a TV commercial criticizing Sidman, her opponent, over her views on a homeless encampment near Uptown that was erected sometime during the pandemic.
When a Charlotte homeless encampment was overrun with rats and disease, Sidman opposed a bipartisan plan to clear it.
You say that this is misleading, Steve. Why?
Yeah, it really is. The commercial is referring to a blog post that Nicole Sidman made. She works at Temple Beth El, and it was a blog post for the synagogue. And what she wrote a year later was about the site being removed was, look, that at the time when all of the people who were homeless were together, they were top of mind. It made us think about them. It made us think about their needs. Now they're dispersed, and we really don't think about them anymore. She didn't say she opposed the site. She didn't say that. It was just kind of a, like, where are they now? And it's interesting because Tricia Cotham's mother, Pat Cotham, says the exact same thing constantly. It's one of her big issues in terms of taking care of the homeless community. Pat Cotham said this basically same thing in interview after interview. Where are they? We need to be thinking about them. So it was a it was an attack ad against Nicole Sidman, and it was also an attack ad really against what her mother, Trisha Cotham, or Pat Cotham, believes.
Irony. Some more good news up in the mountains. We spoke this week to the mayor of Hendersonville, one of the towns pretty much spared the worst of Hurricane Helene. They are open for business, she says, and they want tourists to drop in Hendersonville. Portions of the Blue Ridge Parkway are reopening. And this week, during a briefing in Asheville, Governor Cooper said that, quote, essential-only travel ban in western North Carolina has been lifted. That may seem like an invitation to drive en masse up there this weekend to watch the leaves change. Is it, or should people be checking in with the locations they'd like to visit to see if they can accommodate visitors at this stage of the game? Anybody?
People probably should be really cautious of where they're going because they still have, I think, 400 roads that are closed. So you might run into some transportation issues if you don't have your route worked out exactly. So I would check whatever town or city you're planning on going to before you get in your car.
So let me stick with you for a second, Alex. The Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board has updated its policies with more explicit language about students being harassed because of gender identity and expression and sexual orientation. What changes did the school board make?
This was just kind of a standard policy update. They were just making it more clear in their harassment policy that you can't harass students because of their gender expression, sexual orientation, and pregnancy was in there as well. But CMS says that these were things that they were already protecting. They were just making it more explicit.
CMS, the board also unanimously approved a new goal for the district. They want 85% of students who graduate on time to also be on track to be enrolled, I guess, in college or higher education, enlisted in the military, or employed by June of 2029. What does this mean?
So basically, they want to make sure that students are not only just graduating on time, but when they graduate, they have some kind of plan for the future. It is ambitious because right now, only 72% of students are on track, and they have a few ways that they're measuring this, but there are different indicators, and they're hoping that students meet at least one of them. Like, for example, they're making the right testing scores. But they also need to just get their graduation rate up. It's pretty low right now compared to the rest of the state.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill admits that that 85% goal is ambitious since only 72% of those students met those criteria in 2023.
This goal is focused specifically on the students who graduate on time with their four-year cohort. It is important that we focus on these students with the understanding that our four-year graduation rate should always be at least 90%. Beyond our goals, we are laser focused on ensuring all students graduate on time.
So what, if anything, are they doing to ensure that, Alex?
That's a great question, but I think it's just making sure they meet the indicators, making sure they're either testing right or they're on some kind of career technical pathway or something else, some kind of student outreach. But this week it was just kind of setting the goal.
So there was this massive construction fire last year at South Park, Nick, at an apartment complex under construction. Two workers died because they were unable to escape from one of the higher floors, I think the sixth floor. The families of the workers sued Mill Creek Residential, the site's developer, the contractor, and the subcontractors, alleging a series of their failures led to their family members' deaths. But now the companies are warning that they may use something called the contributory negligence defense. It's only allowed in four states, including North Carolina and Washington, D.C. What is it?
It basically says that if you were contribute to your own demise, in this case, you were contributory negligent, and that means you didn't do enough to help yourself. Now, that is a defense. You'd expect them to assert that. Essentially, what they're saying is the two men who died failed to help themselves. I think if you watch any of my colleague David Hodges' reporting on the South Park fire, which has been extensive, you'll know that I don't know that's going to hold up in court, but that is the defense you would expect them to say.
Their argument is that other workers got out, and some of those workers were on floors higher than the sixth floor. They got out, so they're saying essentially that if they didn't escape, it's on them. That's what they're saying?
Essentially, and what we know is there was no alarm system. The warning mechanism was a guy running up and down the stairs yelling, fire, fire, fire. They were more than a football field away from those stairs, so you probably wouldn't hear anyone yelling, fire, fire, fire. I'm not exaggerating. That was the warning mechanism. And so they have that to contend with when they get into court.
Well, Charlotte, football's not doing well. It was embarrassing again last week. They're playing Denver this week in Denver with another changeup in quarterbacks because there was an accident involving our first-string quarterback, Andy Dalton. He's out. Bryce Young is in. We'll see what happens this week. Charlotte FC, though, is playoff-bound for the second year in a row and the second of their two seasons. They'll host that game at Bank of America Stadium on November the 1st, part of a best-of-three series that will start in Florida against Orlando and move to Charlotte for game two. So something to look forward to if you're a sports fan and go to Bank of America Stadium. Steve Harrison, Mary C. Curtis, Nick Oxner, Alexandria Sands, thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.